Welcome, everyone, to VBC Greatest Generation Live. This is our special Thursday night program, all centered on Masters of the Air. This is the first of a series over the next couple of months that we will be hosting. Joining me is Glenn Flickinger, who will be the host of the Masters of the Air program. Glenn, how are you doing tonight?
Excellent. Really looking forward to this.
Wonderful. I'll be handing it off to you in just a minute. Chloe, you will be joining us as our special guest tonight. Chloe, if you could wave just to give everyone a hello. Thank you. How are you doing this evening?
Great. Oh, I see a copy of Luck of the Draw out there. Wonderful. Woohoo!
We'll get everybody to hold up their copy.
Yeah, we'll have to get a picture tonight. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Sean, it's a great pleasure to be here again. This is the first of 11 consecutive Thursday nights that we're going to dedicate to Masters of the Air. The program starts on Apple TV Friday, January 26th. And every Thursday after that, we'll be having a program. We'll also have a program next Thursday, another sort of introductory program. So we're really thrilled about doing this. We've had many an 8th Air Force veteran, made many 8th Air Force authors and experts on the program over the years, 15th Air Force as well. We're not going to forget about them. So we're looking forward to diving into the history, getting into some chat and comments about what everybody thought about the episode the previous week. And every week we are going to have an author, an expert on World War II, and we hope a veteran. The veteran side is hard to guarantee that we'll always have a veteran on, but we're hoping to. So before I introduce Chloe, though, let me ask, do we have any of our World War II veterans on the program tonight? Could you identify themselves? Sean, do you see any on your screen? Joe Peterbus, maybe? Just wave.
If anybody would like to wave your hand if you're a World War II veteran. I'm checking through now. I know I saw Joe Peterbus in the waiting room earlier. So I'm sure we have... I don't see anybody just yet, but I'm sure that we will have some people showing up throughout the program.
Okay. And there's some other authors that I invited on. Steve Snyder from California, who wrote a great book about his father called Shot Down. His father was shot down, a B-17 pilot, and escaped capture and eventually escaped back to England. David White is on. I'm not sure if his wife Margaret is on. They wrote the great book on the P-51 and the development of P-51 and the story that it plays into this. And I think I see a man by the name of Sandy Alderson. I see your name, Sandy. Todd or Sean, could you unmute Sandy? And
I
see him.
Yep, I send it. There we go.
There we go. I'm here.
Hello, Sandy Alderson. It's a pleasure to see you and to meet you. And thanks very much to the kind introduction by Chloe.
Chloe makes many glowing introductions. Don't believe all of them.
You're living up to our expectations so far. Sandy, I know you're a very accomplished man, but the key point here is you're on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Museum with Chloe. Do I have that correct?
Correct, yes. I'm honored to be serving in that capacity with Chloe. she's provided great leadership over many years to the 8th Air Force Museum.
I've been there two or three times. Anytime I drive past Savannah, the car stops just automatically.
Well, it's a great museum, and it's a museum that needs to continue to exist.
Yes.
As a living, tangible memorial to the sacrifices, the successes of the 8th Air Force, and to a generation of amateur flyers, really, who accomplished so much in a short period of time.
Yep. It's such a great story. It's got to live on forever. We've got to remember these men and remember the contribution they made. Sam, one last question, Sandy. Do you have a connection to the 8th Air Force personally? Was a relative or your father involved with the 8th Air Force?
Yes, my father was a pilot, a B-24 pilot in the 44th Bomb Group, which was part of the 8th Air Force, and flew 32 missions.
Wow. Wow. Fascinating. Okay. Well, listen, we'll move on to Chloe, but as the program goes on, if you've got any questions or comments, please feel free to bring them up.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for being on. And to our audience in general, as you have questions, please place them in the chat room. Eventually, I'll stop here and there and ask for any questions, but let's get started. And Chloe Milas, hello. Thank you so much for being on.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. I've been really, really looking forward to this. And, you know, I hope I can answer your questions.
We're pleased to have you on. The fundamental point, as I think all of you know by now, is Chloe is the grandfather of one Frank Murphy. He wrote this memoir 20 or so years ago, Luck of the Draw. And that's what the basis of our conversation is going to be about tonight. Frank was a navigator in the 100th Bomb Group, the Bloody 100, in a B-17, was shot down in the famous Munster Raid, and was a prisoner of war for 18 plus months. So it's an incredible story, which, as you can tell, all our people that come on, they know Glenn's read a book because I have put all the pasties in it, and it's my little way of keeping notes. So, Chloe, first of all, why don't you just tell us about yourself, your career, what you're doing now?
Sure. Well, I'm a mom to two little boys, ages 4 and 6, and they are waiting to be put to bed. They're staying up late tonight, and they're upstairs, and I've given them strict instructions not to come down and interrupt because dad's out of town. I am a journalist. I work at NBC News. I just started working at NBC News over the summer, well, at the end of the summer. I had previously been at CNN here in New York, is where I live, and I had worked at CNN for about 8 years. And I've been covering entertainment news for 17 years. But although it started lighter fare and red carpets and parties and who's dating who, it turned much more serious at CNN. And I cover all sorts of things and trials and crime. And it really isn't celebrity news. It's really becomes mainstream news. And so you can find me several days a week on the Today Show. And occasionally I'm on Nightly News with Lester Holt. And then you can also see me occasionally on MSNBC. And I write for NBCnews.com. So they call it multi-platform. So I am full-time, but I pop up everywhere. So you never know where you might see me pop up, which it's actually kind of fun. So it keeps things interesting.
Sounds like a fascinating career, Chloe, and a very busy one. I don't know where you get time to do everything you do.
I don't sleep a lot, but as my grandmother always said, I'll sleep when I'm dead. So maybe that's just that. That's what I'll do.
So, Chloe, let me fumble here for a minute and try to share my screen with everybody. Sean, be ready to help me at any moment.
I got you covered, Glenn.
Okay. Are we seeing this? Let me get it expanded a bit. And play from start. Where's that button?
Slideshow. There you go.
See that okay?
There you go.
There we go. Chloe, I've got some pictures of your grandfather a little bit later on, but I thought I'd start with this. Tell us about these three lovely ladies.
So that's myself, my mom next to me, Elizabeth, and my grandmother, Anne. Anne will be 94 in May. And my mother and my grandmother, they both live in Atlanta, Georgia. My mom is one of four siblings, and two of which unfortunately have passed away. But Frank Murphy was married to Anne for 50 plus years. Wow. And they had four children together. And that's the three of us a couple years ago. And my grandmother is very happy about the book, and she is so excited about Masters of the Air. So we're just excited that she's lived long enough to be able to see the series.
That's got to be just a wonderful event for her and for your family and entire family, but for your grandma to be able to see the series and see the actor that's going to be playing your grandfather has got to be something very special.
Oh yeah. I mean, they did a Zoom with Jonas Moore, the actor who's playing my grandfather, last year or a year and a half ago. I was actually just on a virtual event for the Telegraph in the United Kingdom today with Jonas. And that was really neat. I met him for the first time last week in Los Angeles at the premiere. We had been corresponding on social media. And I just love him to death. He is stuck with the Murphy family now, I told him.
I can't wait to see what they look like when just like in the previous shows, Band of Brothers and the Pacific, when these actors play these actual real life characters, it's always amazing to me how they seem to have picked actors that could really pass as those men when they were young men. So it's the miracle of TV or production. So, Chloe, tell us the story behind the book. The book was published, self-published, I take it, by your grandfather 20 plus years ago. What happened to it and how did you find it again?
Yeah, I mean, so 23 years ago, 2001, and it's kind of a hybrid self-published, not self-published. So my grandfather spent about 10 years writing the book in retirement. He was a great writer, as you can see. Incredible researcher, a little bit of a historian. I'm sure I get some of my inquisitive nature from him, although he was a lot quieter than me. And so he was toiling away on this, and he always said he was just doing it for the family, not for any other reason. And so he, through the grapevine, passed the manuscript over to a man by the name of John O'Neill, who had a small publishing company down south called F&P. It's like Food and Nutrition Press. And so he said, well, let me help you publish your book. I'll do the print run. And so my grandfather, you know, paid for the print run, and they did a couple hundred copies. And my grandfather would go and, you know, sell these at the Mighty 8th Air Force Museum in Pooler, or he would travel around the country. He'd hand them out to anybody that wanted one, or the birthplace chapter of the Mighty 8th Air Force in Savannah. And any money that he ever got from the book, he would give it right back to the museum or the 100th Bomb Group Foundation. And so, you know, it was out of print basically from the moment that it came out. They printed a maybe couple hundred copies, and then they did it again about a year later. And then they basically just sat in excess in my grandmother's storage unit in her building. And so I didn't read the book until several years later, probably like 2008-09, when I graduated college. And, you know, when I was in college, I went to Thorpe Abbotts, and I write about that in the foreword. And that's the Air Force base where my grandfather flew out of in Northern England. And so I always had an interest in my grandfather's story. I loved him very much. And I was one of the grandchildren that got to listen to those stories because I spent so many weekends at their home. And then when I was in my mid-20s, I went to go listen to Don Miller speak at the Atlanta History Center one weekend when I was living in New York. I came down, and I at the time had already been to a 100th Bomb Group reunion. And so I was just slowly getting indoctrinated into this wonderful tribe of humans that are now some of my best friends, including Dan Rosenthal, the son of Rosie Rosenthal. We talk so much, we're sick of each other. And, you know, when I knew that Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg had optioned Don Miller's book, and I knew that there was a TV show coming out, I just had the foresight, I guess, to go to my family and tell them, we need to publish this book. But it probably wasn't until I knew that my grandfather was a character in the series. And so this was more around, I'm 37 now, so probably around like 32. It was definitely during the pandemic. And I went to my agents because yes, when you're in the news business, you have an agent. It sounds bougie, but it's basically like a glorified headhunter and you need one. And I went to my agents and I said, I have this book. My grandfather wrote it. Here's the spiel. Can I send you guys a copy? And I sent it to the guy who handles books at Creative Arts Agency, Anthony Matero. And he read it and he said, this is really great. Let's create a proposal. Let's send it to different publishers. And we sent it around. And actually, John Lucky Luckadoo, who is 102 now, I think, who's also become a friend of mine, who was a pilot during World War II, he had had a book come out the year before with St. Martin's Press called Damn Lucky, that was written by Kevin Maurer. And so it just happened to be St. Martin's. They wanted another crack at World War II and the 8th Air Force. So they bought the book and we took all that money and put it right back into publicity and marketing. And I spent the next 3 years helping, doing whatever I could. I got the old gang back together of the individuals that helped originally, like historians and individuals within the 100th, like Mike Faley, who helped my grandfather, and people like Paul Andrews and others who, worked on the appendices in the back. So we updated these. It was very labor intensive. And I had, this book was written on a typewriter, so it wasn't digitized. So that was a mission in itself. And then I had to go, there's a funny story, but I won't tell you now, but there's a funny story about how I had to go home to Atlanta and search for all the photos in the book because we didn't know where they were from. We didn't know where they were. It had credits on them, but we didn't know where to start. And I eventually found them in my grandmother's apartment. Then it was about a year of planning this publicity blitz, right? Because he's not around to promote the book. So it's a bit unconventional. We're publishing it posthumously. And I have been going around and talking to anybody that will listen to me and leveraging every single media contact that I have and every bit of goodwill I've earned over 17 years in this business. And it all paid off because it became a New York Times bestseller. And I am really tired, but but I'm very happy.
Glenn, there's one question in the chat that came in. How did your father become a character in the series before republish?
Yeah, so John Orloff, the screenwriter of Masters of the Air, who adapted Don Miller's book into a screenplay, he got his hands on my grandfather's book. I think he must have bought it on Amazon. There were copies circulating of the original book that were like, you know, $40, $75. And he used it as a primary source before he stumbled upon A Wing and a Prayer written by Harry Crosby. And then he sort of pivoted, and I'll let John Orloff speak for himself because I don't want to speak for him. But the two primary books used for Masters of the Air were A Wing and a Prayer and were Masters of the Air. But Don Miller knew my grandfather. And so basically, I was at one of these 100th Bomb Group reunions and John told me your grandfather's a character in this. And I mean, I was hoping that that might happen, but I never asked for it. I would never dare ask for him to be put in. I was just excited for the 100th to be the focus. My grandfather did meet Don Miller, and my grandfather is mentioned a little bit in Masters of the Air in Don's book. And my grandfather was a source. My grandfather was interviewed by Don among many people for Masters of the Air, which came out, I believe, in like 2007, right around the time that my grandfather passed away. So my grandfather never lived to know that Masters of the Air was optioned by Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. And obviously, unfortunately, didn't live to find out that he would be immortalized as a character. And also, let me be clear, Frank is not one of the main stars of this. He is a supporting character, but I'm just happy that he's a part of this rocket ship, no matter how big or small the role.
Yeah, it's. I'm sure it's going to be incredibly interesting.
I've seen the episodes, so all of them, and it's fantastic. So
we're jealous, envious of that.
Don't worry, it comes out in a week, right? So you'll be able to appointment viewing television.
Yeah, but then there's that weekly dribble, you know, waiting for the next one.
I know, but that's the way that you're supposed to watch TV, right, you guys? So
one of those streaming channels that does it a little different, but. The other thing I want to say about this book, you know, as my friends on this, the people that know me on this program know, I've read dozens. I don't even think about how many books I've read about World War II. I've read dozens of memoirs of 8th Air Force, 15th Air Force veterans. And the way I got a hold of this is I saw you and your mother on, I think it was the World War II Museum in New Orleans. And I saw that broadcast and I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I bought the book and it went on my pile over there with about a pile of 20 other unread books. And then one day I said, okay, I'm going to read it because I have to tell you, half the memoirs, especially the self-published ones, they're hard to read. They're frankly just, you know, they're not professionally written. So it's a bit of a slug through them. You have to be a real devotee to want to read some of them. This one, I was amazed. It reads like a professional writer wrote it. And your father was a very intelligent man, or your grandfather, obviously. He was a corporate professional, and it's reflected in the way he put this book together and the way he wrote it. It's just amazing to me. So it's well worth reading.
He is, you know, my mom's a children's author. I'm a writer. One of my cousins is a writer, definitely runs in the blood. He's a far better writer than I ever could be. He was so smart. And I think he actually said, if my mom was here, she could tell you, but I'm pretty sure that he said that if he hadn't become a lawyer, he would have wanted to have been a writer.
Yeah.
Someone in the family worked for a newspaper. I genuinely believe that those things are genetic. But yes, it's not just a run of the mill, and not that there's anything wrong with it. It's not a published diary or something like that. This is a damn well researched book. And that is one of the reasons why I've been championing this. I mean, look at the appendices, look at the footnotes. He did his homework.
Yeah. And then we won't get into it right now, but hopefully a little bit later. There's a story within the story within the story about how he came to write the book and how he came to research and investigate his past, which let's save that for a little bit later.
Sure.
It's also fascinating in its own right. So, okay. Well, look, I think what we'd like to do next is Chloe shared with us this about 10 or 12 minute film.
I think it's four or five minutes.
Okay. Which I've watched. It's very well done. And I thought we'd share that with our audience as a start to get into the actual story of Frank Murphy in World War II. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I will play.
7 weeks after Nazi Germany declares war on the United States, the U.S. Army's 8th Air Force is activated at an armory in Savannah, Georgia. Its mission? Transfer to England. Create a heavy bomber force. Defeat Nazi Germany through high-altitude daylight strategic bombing. The 8th Air Force will become the largest air armada ever committed to battle.
My name is Frank D. Murphy, M-U-R-P-H-Y. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia on September 9, 1921. I grew up in Atlanta and spent all of my life, well, not quite all of my life. I had 2 years in Cleveland, Ohio in 1929 and 30 during the Depression. It was the only place my father could get a job. So we went to Cleveland for 2 years. We came back to Atlanta in 1931. I was in Atlanta up until the war started in December of 1941. I knew that very likely I was going to get involved because several months before that, they had revised the draft requirements so that anyone from age 21 was subject to it would be subject to the draft, and we knew that eventually anybody my age who was healthy was going to have to go into the military. Well, I decided that if I was going to go into the military, I wanted to go into the U.S. Army Air Corps, which had just recently been changed to the U.S. Army Air Force's. The name had been changed in June of 1941. I was a student at Emory University at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and I had gone out to the airport in Atlanta and taken flying lessons, and had soloed in a little Piper Cub, and I flew, and I enjoyed flying, so I knew that when my time came, I would want to go into the Army Air Forces. We could see our own airplanes going down, getting shot down, and it was just a frightening sight. Some ME-109 fighter aircraft came in, and one got in behind us and shot us and killed our tail gunner, and then started two fires in the airplane, one in the radio room and one in the number three engine. I looked around and I saw the co-pilot coming down from the flight deck, and he motioned for me to follow him, and he pulled the release handle on the forward escape hatch. It fell away and he jumped out. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, we've got to go. So with that, I managed to get my parachute on and I went back and I followed him out the door. I fell for not terribly long. I'm at 20,000 feet. I was anxious to find out if the parachute was going to work. So I pulled the D-ring, and fortunately it did work. Before I hit the ground, I realized how fast I was falling. When I hit the ground, of course, I sprained my left ankle very, very badly. And while I was there struggling to get out of my parachute, some German farmers came up, and a lady standing there said to me in perfect English, "For you, the war is over," which was something that thousands of American flyers heard during the war.
Wow, that's so very well done, Chloe. Are we back on here, Sean? Everybody hearing us?
Yes, you are. You're good to go. Chloe, I'll ask you to unmute.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that that video is being put to good use. We worked on that video and with the thanks of the Mighty 8th Air Force Museum in Savannah, we were able to take parts of a video they had, parts of a video I had, and some photos that I had. And I had a really great editor named Mark splice it all together for me while I was promoting the book. I actually just put it on Instagram today. I get emotional every time between the music and then also hearing my grandfather speak. So I can only imagine how I'm going to feel after the finale of Masters of the Air, because a documentary, which I don't think has really been publicized, the 10th episode of Masters of the Air is a documentary about the men behind the series, and it's called The Bloody 100th, and my grandfather's in that. So I don't know what interviews they've used or found, but I hear it's really powerful. So yeah, I'm excited.
So where did the interview of your father come from? Were those 8th Air Force Museum interviews?
I don't know.
I'm a grandfather. I keep saying father, grandfather.
Oh, that's okay. Don't worry about it. I get it all the time, and he was like a father to me too. So it's fair, actually. But I don't know. He did different interviews and I don't know the source of that. I think that was the Mighty 8th Air Force Museum in Savannah, Grant, because it was something from them. But he did a few different interviews, yeah, which is great. I'm so happy for that.
It's great seeing him in his prime like that.
And also just to hear it in his own,
yeah,
just to hear him in his own words say it, you know, because I obviously wasn't there. I'm doing the best I can to try to talk about him and his experiences, but that's why I think it's so important to share the video and to hear it from him, you know, and then I can supplement where necessary.
Right, right. Sean, I see quite a few posts in the chat, but I haven't read them. Are there questions from the audience that can be asked?
Chloe? A couple comments. Carol Popchak said, "Navigators were no slouches. From what I've learned researching my cousin's experiences training as a pilot for the 15th U.S. Army Air Force, navigators were as highly trained as pilots. Often pilots who didn't make it all the way through pilot training and were redeployed as navigators so as not to lose all of that skill."
Yeah, my grandfather wanted to be a pilot, but due to issues with his eyesight, he became a navigator. So, and he wanted to be an officer. So that's why he decided to go to navigator school. and he was very smart and had a very calm temperament, which is the type of temperament that you would need to try to get you to your, you know, bomb site and back and figure out how to maybe detour after Regensburg with a, you know, badly shot up plane and get you to Africa. So, you know, he did that, and that's amazing. And you'll see that in Masters of the Year. They show them going to Africa. They show them in Regensburg, and you see my grandfather's plane in all these missions. You might not always see my grandfather, but you see his crew. And I love that.
Yeah. And what was the name of his plane, Chloe?
Couple different ones. The main plane that he flew in was Bastard's Bungalow, which I just love. It's just so great. And that's the plane I always knew growing up because it was something that stuck with me because it had a bad word in it. It just sounded like something out of a movie. But the plane that he flew in when he was shot down was called, I can't even say it correctly, Argo. And no one knows what it means. He writes in the book that it's confounding. And if anyone can ever figure out what it means, I should put it on Reddit and ask the internet sleuths to go and figure out what does it mean. No one knows. Yeah. But yes.
Interesting. And this is him standing in front of one of the planes?
No, that is not him. We have a lot of photos of different individuals. But if you, I see several of him, that's him. That's a wonderful photo of him. That next one is him. And I'm trying to remember where that was taken. If you keep going. Oh, I love that one.
The one with his buddies. Is he in? No.
Okay. Now, if you keep going down of him in the jacket, I can read you those captions. And then obviously there's the prisoner of war ID card, which actually I owe back to the Mighty Air Force Museum, Sandy. I had some of his things on loan, actually. Chloe,
yes. Sorry to interrupt. Ira asked, was it all Argo, A-L-L, all Argo, or A-U?
A-W.
Okay.
Argo. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll have some of our sleuths working on that very quickly here, Chloe.
Great. Yeah. Well, no one's been able to figure it out. Those are some really great photos. My grandfather was the middle child, one of three boys. And his younger brother enlisted in the Navy, but not until 1945. His older brother did not, and was a doctor, Mike. Thought that I would share that.
What's incredible striking me right now as we flip through these pictures is here's your grandfather fairly soon after he joined the Air Force, I would guess.
Yeah, it says that was actually August 1945.
Oh, actually. Wow. After.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, here, this was after.
Here he's looking very handsome, very clear-eyed, very handsome man. Then you look at this picture, of course, it's a ID picture from a prisoner of war camp. You'd hardly know it was the same man. So you wonder about the suffering that he went through, the problems that they had in the prisoner of war camp.
So he was a POW in Stalag Luft 3. I saw one of the questions there. So same prison camp where the Great Escape took place. And after a deadly march to Moosburg, to Stalag 7A, where he was a prisoner of war, you know, by that point he had lost over 50 pounds. He had lice, dysentery, pneumonia, and he was taken to a hospital. He was taken to Camp Lucky Strike in France, and then he boarded a ship and came back to the United States, and then he finished his schooling at Emory University, and put all these memories away and didn't talk about them again. And it was in the 80s that he read a book by Lynn Dayton called Goodbye, Mickey Mouse. And he learned about these reunions of these men getting together because he was able to connect with Lynn Dayton after he read the book. And that is what inspired him to start going to these 100th Bomb Group reunions and reconnect with men that he flew with, people from his crew, and just people from his bomb group. And then I think it was seeing others write books that inspired him and gave him something to do during retirement. And that's when he started writing the book in the early 90s.
Now, don't I recall that, and it's been 6 months or more since I've read the book, that he was on a business trip to the Middle East and he stopped in England, as I recall. And it was in England that he started researching the background. And he got in touch with one of the of an English author who was writing a book on the Munster Raid. Do I have that anywhere near correct, Chloe?
Yes. So he was living in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and he was running the offices for Lockheed Martin over there. And so he occasionally would travel while overseas due to the proximity to Europe. And he was on a flight to England, and my grandmother loved to read paperback books. And she would just go rip through them. And she was reading Goodbye, Mickey Mouse on this airplane to England. And she said, "You've got to read this, Frank. I think they're writing about your book, your bomb group." And so she gave it to him and he tore through it. And when he got off the plane, he contacted the publisher and he said, "I need to speak to Lynn Dayton." So Ian Hawkins, my grandfather struck up a friendship with him.
Yeah.
And my grandfather became pen pals with him, and my grandfather went and helped him with one of his books and then was very supportive of my grandfather's journey to write his.
Right, right. Sean, anything we should address in the chat?
No, not at this time. Tom Stein said the aircraft name is possibly related to a 1940s knock-knock joke. The Argo, a popular radio announcer back in the 1940s, was doing man in the street interviews. You guys could see this in the chat. Knock knock said a drunken man. Who's there? Said the announcer. Argo who? So maybe.
Okay. Maybe. Interesting. So we'll have to keep digging and see. But that could be good. Keep it coming, and you guys can email me your ideas too. I'm into it. You know, I think that what is just so special about all of this is, look, all the bomb groups are important. All the squadrons are important. And I just think that the fact that individuals are going to get a chance, and especially a younger generation, to see this all play out on screen with some of the biggest TV stars today, Austin Butler, Band of Brothers in the Pacific really didn't have big actors at the time. They became big actors later, like Damian Lewis and others. So this is a big opportunity for a lot of people to learn about these very tough conditions and what these men did. And I think people are going to be blown away. And the CGI in Masters of the Air and the attention to detail is incredible. I know that there are over 300 speaking parts in Masters of the Air, and there were over 3,000 costume fittings. And Colleen Atwood is the famous costume designer who did the costumes for Masters of the Air. So, this is not only going to live on in perpetuity, it's like Apple's first original series. They own they did this in-house with Playtone and Amblin, Steven Spielberg's production company. But, you know, it's wild to think that people are going to know the stories of, you know, Bucky, Egan, Buck Clevin. They're going to learn about Harry Crosby, Frank Murphy. They're going to learn about, Ken Lemons and so many interesting people. They're going to learn about Thorpe Abbotts, which desperately needs funding to continue to be a museum, and Ron and Carol Bately, this adorable couple who take care of Thorpe Abbotts. I just hope that it supports also the museum in Savannah and that there's this new interest in these men and in the 8th Air Force. Because you still hear people today talking about Band of Brothers and talking about the Pacific. So I do hope that that happens with Masters, because they worked so hard on it. And John Miller, John Orloff, who wrote the screenplay, I mean, he spent 10 years on it.
Let me recognize somebody that I see in the chat room here that I know has been emailing with Todd, but I've not had the chance to speak with him. And Chloe, I don't know if you know him, Colin Heaton. Colin, are you there? Todd or Sean, can you?
I've asked Colin to unmute.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi, Colin. Do you know Chloe by chance through this connection with?
I do not. This is the first time I've had the pleasure.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
I posted something in there. I have the actual combat records of every German fighter pilot in World War II, and I interviewed over 100 of them. And I'm going to dig, and I think I may know the name of the pilot who shot your grandfather's B-17 down. I'm going to give it a shot and see if I can dig that out.
Oh, that would be amazing. Really?
I just need to know the time of engagement and the exact location, and then I can coordinate that. Correlate that information with my Luftwaffe records, the Abschüsse, and go through my interviews. And man, I might have even interviewed the guy if he survived the war. So it's kind of a skullduggery exercise for me right now. So
that's great. Wow. See, this is what makes this so wonderful. Well, so I rely heavily on Michael Faley. He is a 100th Bomb Group enthusiast, has no personal connection to the 100th, but knew my grandfather, has served on the board of the 100th Bomb Group Foundation, and helped me with the book. I thank him in the front of the book, and he's a historian credited in the credits of Masters of the Air. He knows all of these answers, so I'll put you guys on an email, and he can give you everything. And that's so great. So I look forward to that. And I also, my next mission, if you want to call it that, I want to find the family members of those that were killed on my grandfather's airplane at some point. Because there were two men on his crew that died on the day of the Munster mission. So I want to find those families. You know, obviously I don't think they had children, but I want to try to find them.
Colin, if you're still there, let me ask you, in the chat, you say you interviewed Curtis LeMay.
Oh, I knew Curtis, yeah.
So he frankly is one of my favorite of the 8th Air Force. He's a fascinating man, at least while he was in the 8th Air Force and in World War II. Credited with coming up with the box formation. Credited with coming up with the initial point, the IP point, and so forth. Well, and in Chloe's book, in Frank's book, he mentions Curtis LeMay a couple of times. And He was in the debriefing room with Curtis LeMay after that famous Regensburg mission, I think it was.
Yeah, my full interview with LeMay is in my book, Above the Reich, and along with Robin Olds and Jimmy Doolittle and some others I interviewed. But Curtis LeMay, General Gallen, Adolf Gallen, who's a great friend of mine, and Lieutenant Colonel Walter Dahl of JG-300 and several the German pilots credited Curtis LeMay with creating the box formation that really cost the lives of most German pilots outside of fighter contact. So Curtis LeMay really doesn't get much play, but he played a major role in keeping the 8th Air Force alive with mathematics and geometry, as he called it.
Right, right. He was an Ohio State graduate and was another brilliant man. And as I say about all the Ohio State graduates, well, nobody's perfect, right? I mean,
and the thing about LeMay,
he'd been a Penn State graduate, be different. Yes.
All right. Once he created the box formation, that was when Egon Meyer and Georg Peter Ader, who I interviewed, had to develop the head-on attack technique because they could no longer just attack the trail formation without getting shot up. That's when they went to the head-on attack technique. Then, of course, the B-17F became the G with the chin turret to counter the frontal attack. So Curtis LeMay was the catalyst for all of that.
Yeah, and we should mention to the audience that maybe isn't as steeped in history as many are, that the 8th Air Force and the 100th Bomber Squadron, along with the other four or five of the initial squadrons that were sent there, fought in the nastiest, most difficult part of the air war over Europe, and that was 1943. when these missions, mission after mission after mission, was performed with as few as 60, 70 planes. Maybe it wasn't the days of the 1,000 airplane raids that we saw in 1945. And they did it mostly, and this was the key problem, they did it mostly without effective fighter escort. Mm-hmm. And suffered because of that lack of fighter escort, which is a whole nother story, as told by David and Margaret White in their book about the development of the P-51.
Yeah.
Once the P-51 came about and Jimmy Doolittle took over in early 44, it changed dramatically. And of course, all of a sudden we had hundreds and hundreds of planes in the air.
Well, Jimmy Doolittle argued with Ira Aker about tactics and strategy, and Jimmy Doolittle told Hub Zimke in the 56th Fighter Group, who were already doing it against orders, just take your fighters and find the Germans and kill them before they get the bombers get there, you know, just hunt them down. So,
right. It changed the war.
It did.
Changed the war. Okay. So, Coy, without giving away anything that would get you in trouble, I imagine there's quite a bit in the series about the POW experience.
So, the P-51, that's in there. So that's interesting. And as you see in the trailer, the Tuskegee Airmen, that's in there as well. You see them in Stalag Luft 3. And I'm not giving anything away. This is in the trailer. And if you watch enough of the snippets that are out there, you see them in Stalag Luft 3. You see them do the march to Stalag 7A. And I was really happy about that. My grandfather actually, it's become kind of famous now, this shoe. I have one of the shoes. We don't know what happened to the other one that he wore on that march.
Wow.
Mooseburg, I know. It's the one thing that I don't want to part with yet.
Is it wooden?
Yeah.
Oh. I can't imagine.
I can't imagine either.
No.
He traded shoes. He writes about it in the book. He traded shoes with, because his leather soles were getting wet. You'll see Stalag Luft 3, you'll see Stalag 7A. You see a lot of, you see them a little bit before the war, obviously. And then a lot of Thorpe Abbotts, you know, those, you see the ground crew and their stories. You see what life is like for these men when their friends don't come back. You see what they have to go through. And you also see Rosie Rosenthal, you know, who we know goes to the Flak House.
Right.
And that's interesting, because that's not something that my grandfather experienced. So I was exposed to different things, right? And you see Harry Crosby, who becomes the lead navigator of the 418th, right? And what life looks like for him after that, which is interesting. So I see a lot of different things of all the different experiences. And I hope that everyone that had a family member that flew in the Air Force during World War II, no matter the bomb group, sees a little bit of something that they recognize. You know, it's 9 episodes. You can't get to everything. You can't extensively do everything, but it's almost like 9 different movies, right? And I have to tell you, that the finale is just unbelievable. Might be one of the best episodes of television ever. And I think this show is going to win every Emmy you watch in a year.
So let's talk about maybe again, not everybody in the audience know what we mean by Flak House. You want to explain that, Chloe?
I can explain it as best as I can, and anybody else that might want to jump on, like Colin, maybe. But it's for those that have had a very post-traumatic stress, a lot of stress from these missions. Obviously, everyone did, and especially after very, very tough missions like Munster, where Rosie's plane was the only one to come back that day out of all the planes of the 100th that were shot down. You go to this beautiful estate in the countryside, and you have tennis and people waiting on you and good food and you're swimming. And it's obviously like a stark contrast to war. So I don't really know how easily one adapts to that and then is able to then go back to Thorpe Abbott's and continue to fly those missions.
So, yeah, we had, I don't know if Robert Mattson is on tonight. He's the author of a book on Jimmy Stewart. We did an episode with him a year and a half ago. Jimmy Stewart is the celebrity example of PTSD from the 8th Air Force. He couldn't prove it, but he believed Jimmy Stewart spent two different terms in these flak houses, as they came to be called. They were really rest and recreation estates that were set up for these men. And and Don Miller writes about this quite a bit in the book. And in fact, when we had Don on, he told us that he first got started in this when he picked up a report that was written by the doctors who were the psychiatrists to the 8th Air Force. And that's how we got started in researching the story of the 8th Air Force. So it's just amazing that these men suffered the way they do, what we call now PTSD. And at the time, they didn't know what to call it. They knew it was a problem, but they didn't know what to do about it, except rest a bit, take them off of the missions for a few weeks, see if some of them could recover enough to go back, of which many did, but some did not. Very much in a different world than we live in today, where we understand to the extent we can these kind of issues.
Yeah, I did a piece for CNN about the connection between PTSD and the use of psychedelics to help with that and psilocybin. I've become great friends with former governor of Texas, Rick Perry, our former energy secretary, and Rick also serves on the board with Sandy and myself, the Mighty 8th Air Force Museum in Savannah. And so he's put me in touch with a lot of very interesting individuals over the past couple of years as I've learned more. I definitely think that my grandfather had some form of PTSD, and he alludes to that in the book. And I think that's why he didn't talk about it, why he buried it away. He didn't think he was anything special, and he just wanted to get back, go to school and get on with his life and get married, have children. And he lived a wonderful life. I don't know how he didn't lash out or didn't turn to drinking or, abuse, or he did not. So obviously everyone deals with things differently and we're all different, right? And things affect us all differently. My grandfather saw some really horrible things and I wish I could ask him how he did cope with that. And tragedy continued for my grandfather. His daughter died at the age of 34 of breast cancer. And it was a terrible, terrible death. And she left behind a 5-year-old son at the time. And it really fractured our family. And then a couple decades later, he lost his eldest child, his son of the same name, Frank, to kidney cancer. So when my grandfather passed, there were only 2 children left. He also lost one of his 7 grandchildren, which was really sad, Patrick Murphy. So,
Yeah. Well, and in fact, I see Robert Mattson in the chat room. I'm going to ask him to unmute.
Yes, I'm here. Hello. It's been a fascinating show. So Jim did go to the flak house twice. He went flak happy. And I learned that from one of his pilots who spoke with me, who had been shot down, was liberated, came back and saw Jim later in the war, toward the end of the war when he was a full colonel. And Stewart, he couldn't believe how much Stewart had aged, because 20 missions will do that to you. But he learned then about the flak house.
Yeah. Robert, there's a favorite photo of Jimmy Stewart that I pull up that I got from the program we did with you a while ago. That is a photo of him in, I'm going to guess, 1941 or 42, and then photo right next to him in 1945. And it reminds you of seeing a picture of a president when he's first elected versus 8 years later. You know, they age 30 years in 3 years. And that's what happened to Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. The pressure of leading missions and losing men got to him.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if you could quickly, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but quickly tell the story of the famous movie he made, his first movie after World War II, and his experience in making that movie, A Wonderful Life.
Yeah, so he was going through full-blown PTSD when he comes back to Hollywood, and he had aged so much that no one wanted to hire him. And the only job offer he had was from Frank Capra to make this crazy picture about a man who wants to commit suicide and there's an angel. And Stewart wanted nothing to do with it. But it was the only job offer he had. And so he struggled through making this thing. And you can see on screen very clearly the effects of war in him. And he shows it in his performance. When he goes into rages, you know, that's what he was going through. And you see it on screen. And I think it's a really cool aspect of the picture that's become like one of the most beloved of all time is here is this guy just back from the war. And this is what he looked like. And this is how he was feeling at that time.
There it is. There it
there
is.
There you go. That's it.
Who did that? Todd DiBastino must be on the program.
That'd be me, Glenn. Yes, I made it.
Nice job.
Yes, that is the picture.
That's like me before and after having children. But yeah, I mean, I think my grandfather aged tremendously. He definitely came out a man.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to imagine any one of these men that were in that kind of heavy combat not coming away from that experience with some sort of issue in their life. It just, I can't imagine there were some men. I think a few that we've interviewed have said, nah, it didn't bother them. But it's got to be one out of thousands and tens of thousands. Todd, you've tackled this topic a lot in a lot of our programs. And everybody that doesn't know him, which I can't imagine anybody doesn't, Todd DiBastino is on the line now, is on the program.
Yeah, I mean, everybody from what I've read and, you know, I'm talking to veterans, everybody has their breaking point. Nobody knows when it is. Nobody knows exactly what will trigger it. And when it gets to be sent to a flak house, it meant that you could not function. It was not ordinary crippling anxiety, not ordinary crippling terror. It was so beyond anything that, you know, most of us have ever experienced that you couldn't function. I mean, I don't want to go on and on about this, but it's just stunning the kinds of things that you can't do when you're crippled with serious combat stress reaction.
Well, I'm excited for you to see the episode with the flak house because I'm wondering how, like, what your thoughts are on it. If it's accurate, I mean, I'm sure it is, but I'd love to get your thoughts. We should all get together after the series and find out what everybody thinks. You should do. We should like dissect. Are you going to dissect the show, the miniseries?
That's the idea. Every Thursday after the Friday showing, we're going to have an episode to dissect that episode, tell the history, get our experts' opinions on it, our veterans' opinions on it. Then at the very end, we'll come up with something to get everybody on that would like to be on to give their views.
And I just want to say to everybody tonight, because there's so many like beautiful people on tonight and it's just so wonderful. And I know you guys all have your own connections and your own things, but you know, it sounds silly, but these are the kinds of things that in perpetuity help the museum stay around. And we sold some books, not a crazy amount, but enough to get on the bestseller list the first week, then it dropped off. But there is strength in numbers, and it's a groundswell. It's a marathon, you know? So any of you who can spread the word about this book, who can also post about it, or just doesn't mean you have to buy it. Just post the link, share it with anybody that might be interested. It's incredibly helpful because I'm not done with ideas of what to do with my grandfather's story. It doesn't end here with the book. And I think that the fact that his character is not completely fleshed out in Masters of the Air is actually a beautiful gift. Let's just say that. And there's a silver lining to it. And I think, you know, I was told by many people that this book is niche, that, you know, World War II is niche, and that, you know, good luck, it'll never see the best New York Times bestseller list, and that the paperback list is the hardest to get on. And what would, look at that. And guess what number it was? Number 8. And I think that is pretty interesting given the 8th Air Force and it's number 8. I love symbolism. And I thought that was pretty special.
Chloe, is there a preferred bookseller or platform you'd like us to, a link you'd like us to share for people?
No, it doesn't. Okay. I mean, I think if you want to support your local bookstore, or if you want to ask your local bookstore to like carry a copy or two, that would be great. If you really don't want to buy one, I have a whole cabinet of them and I can send you one. And you know, Amazon or any of that would be great. But I have time for just another question or two before my children freak out about not getting the banana and the milk. And they've also added to the order a chocolate chip cookie. So I don't know what they're doing upstairs right now, but they're having a party.
Does mom hide the Oreo cookies while chocolate filling?
Let me tell you, I have such a crazy schedule. So I drink copious amounts of coffee during the day and I wake up at about 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m. to get to the Today Show and get to 30 Rock. And so my husband is super into health and wellness. I love goldfish. I'll leave it at that, right? I love goldfish. I love red wine. I love a cookie. It's a miracle that I have good cholesterol and good blood pressure because I'm definitely not eating healthy. Although I did have a salad today at lunch. So there you go. I have time for just a couple more questions before I have to go, unfortunately.
Yeah, sure. Chloe, you've been just super being with us and dealing with those two.
I wish I could stay on. I would stay on all night if my husband was in town.
But every Thursday evening for the next 10 or 11 Thursdays.
I will be on for John Orloff. I will be on for John for sure.
Okay. Chloe, contact me and I'll put your book on my website because I advertise my friends' books as well as my own.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You're the best. I'm excited to make new friends. And please message me also. My email is just my first and last name at Gmail. It's just ChloeMalas@gmail.com. Or you can message me on Instagram or on Facebook. And if any of you go to these 100th Bomb Group reunions, let me know as well.
So let's allow one last question. If anybody has a question directly for Chloe, and then we'll let her get to her children. Anybody got one?
Oh, yes. Here we go. Oh, Joe Peterburz is with us. Oh, are we? I'm sure you've already said hello to Joe, but hello,
Joe. We tried earlier, but did not. So, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hey.
So hey. Great to see you.
Oh, good.
Hey, guys.
Good to see you. This is my granddaughter.
Daughter.
Hi.
I'm Sabrina. This is my granddad. And Chloe, I just want to tell you it's amazing what you're doing. I still have my granddad here, so I'm able to share in this with him. But the experience that you're giving to everyone is pretty amazing. And we wish you much luck. Your story is amazing. Your grandfather's story is amazing. I'm going to get the book. The shoe that you shared brought tears to my eyes because my granddad was a POW as well. And I share that. I just want to say thank you for what you are doing and keeping his legacy alive and sharing it.
Thanks.
And people should know, if they don't already, that Joe was a P-51 pilot in World War II, shot down POW, served in Korea and Vietnam. An American hero.
He also shot down our mutual friend Walter Shook in his 262 jet.
That's right.
And Joe's story, we've had Joe on a couple of times. It's an amazing story because he was a prisoner of war for about a few days, and then he escaped. This is right at the end of the war, and fought with a Russian tank battalion. So, and there's even more twists and turns. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you.
Sandy, don't you have a connection to Vietnam?
You might have to unmute Sandy.
There we go.
Sandy Alderson.
I'm way here.
But I will say, just thank you, though, for saying that, Sabrina. I definitely have operated from a place of, I think the reason people are drawn to the book project, and I'm just guessing here, is, yes, my grandfather's story is very compelling, but also that this is not for personal gain. It's not about money. It's not about me becoming a New York Times bestseller. This isn't my story. And I think that people really have resonated with that. It's just about really loving someone, you know? And I just really loved him. And I think that's really powerful. He was a great person and I miss him so much. So I hope he's proud of what we're doing.
I gotta believe, Chloe, he's very, very proud. Absolutely, no doubt.
All right, Sandy, my bestie. Wait, don't you have a Vietnam connection?
Well, my father, as I said, flew with the 44th Bomb Group in World War II. He was also a Korean War veteran and flew in Vietnam. And I actually flew with him in Vietnam as a 19-year-old journalist in South Vietnam, later was a Marine myself. But my father and I shared those experiences from the Vietnam War, but didn't share enough about World War II. And as I said before, that's one of the reasons that the museum is important to me and that this series will be enlightening as well, shedding light for all of us, but certainly me, on what life was like in those days on those missions.
And also, I just want to say in closing, I think this is a perfect example of why, where did I put it? Write stuff down.
Amen, sister.
Write it down, whether you served in a war or you didn't, whether it's a story you find interesting of a family member or a friend, but this is a grandfather who wrote this in the basement on a typewriter who never in his wildest dreams would expect that not only was it helpful for the most expensive, you know, a very expensive television show, and that it becomes a New York Times bestseller. But I think it also goes to show you that it's almost like not one man's junk is another man's treasure, because this isn't junk and he never thought that. But I think my point of that analogy is that you don't know what a grandchild or a great grandchild might find interesting. He never probably could have picked out of his seven grandchildren that that I was the one, the Barbie, you know, bright pink loving, shopping obsessed granddaughter was the one who ended up carrying the torch, right? So you never know what somebody might find interesting in a future generation. So we all live through the pandemic. We all have seen some wild things, and it might be worth all of us writing things down, or with the age of technology, recording ourselves on our phone on a voice memo, right? And just having some sort of a record of that.
It's why we love to get these veteran stories on video, if nothing else on video, and preferably in writing, which Todd does just a great job of. And you're with us, Chloe. We appreciate that very much. Thank you for being with us.
So thank you all so much for taking the time. And I hope you guys have a big party and continue this after I leave. So enjoy yourselves. I'm going to go get some bananas and milk now, I guess.
Thank you, Chloe.
Okay. Well, that was an incredible hour and 20 minutes or so with Chloe and the 8th Air Force and Masters of the Air. I want to thank everybody for being on. Thanks very much.
You're the best, Glenn. Thank you for putting this together. And thank you to all of you for joining us tonight. And have a good weekend. Stay warm. Stay safe. See you next week. Take care.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco Free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.